Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Are you a history buff? Well, if the answer is yes, then you undoubtedly had a wonderful time on Tuesday night when historian and two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning author David McCullough spoke at Reynolds Auditorium and took questions from the audience. If you missed it, fret not. You can hear part two of our conversation today on Triad Arts Weekend. Then, from Americans in Paris in the 19th century, we'll jump back 300 years further to the time of Italian composer Claudio Monteverdi. The twice Grammy-nominated vocal ensemble Seraphic Fire topped the 2010 iTunes best-selling classical charts with their recording of Monteverdi's Vespers from 1610. Artistic director Patrick Quigley is bringing Seraphic Fire to St. Paul's Episcopal Church this weekend. And we wrap things up back here in the now with Winston-Salem Festival Ballet's Metropolis in a conversation with artistic director, choreographer Gary Taylor. Original music, original story, original choreography, and you'll hear it first, next, on Triad Arts Weekend. Two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning author David McCullough is a master of narrative history. He's twice won the National Book Award, and in 2006, he received the Presidential Medal of Freedom, our nation's highest civilian award. On Tuesday night, February 28th, Guilford College, with support from Bookmarks, brought the noted historian and author to the Triad. He discussed his new book, The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris, with a packed audience in Reynolds Auditorium in Winston-Salem. After his presentation, McCullough took questions from the audience and he signed copies of his new book. The Greater Journey tells the story of a remarkable group of adventurous American artists, doctors, architects, politicians, writers, and others who set off for Paris between 1830 and 1900 and how they were transformed by their experience. Household names like Oliver Wendell Holmes, Mark Twain, Samuel Morse, Harriet Beecher Stowe each braved the high seas to reach the City of Light, where they embarked on an even greater journey of personal discovery. Last week, David McCullough spoke with me by phone from his home in Florida. Here's part two of our conversation. I would love to be in the room, you know, looking over your shoulder when you come across a piece of information in a letter or an entry in a diary.
You just have to read enough and know enough to know something significant, something important, when you see it. Well, an example would be Augustus St. Gaudens, who wrote a very good memoir about his life with the help of his son. And there were plenty of references to St. Gaudens in the letters of his closest friends and tributes written after his death and so forth. But when I really hit the jackpot was finding a collection of letters written by his wife, Gussie, from Paris to her parents every week about their lives, the lives that she and her husband, Augustus, were living in Paris. How his work was going and how the financial situation was working out and so forth. And there were over 200 of them, and they're superbly written and full of her own personality. And every now and then he'd sketch in a little cartoon so you get his sense of humor. These are pure gold in the sense that they take you inside their private lives, inside their true worries and ambitions and pride of accomplishment as they felt it at the moment. You can't get better than that. That's when these people, who were all people, come alive. And they're not just paragraphs in a history book.
Well, that's what you do so well. Bringing, I mean, the human side of this, I just feel as a reader, I'm learning so much more than
a period. Well, history is human. It isn't about dates and memorizing dates. It isn't about having a storage in your mind of usable quotations from history. It's about people. What made them tick? What made them do what they did? And to keep in mind always that they didn't know how it was going to come out any more than we do in our time. And none of it was ever on a track. It wasn't predestined that the young man who went off to study sculpture in Paris would become the greatest American sculptor ever. That might not have happened. And I feel very strongly, and this is one of the main reasons I wanted to write The Greater Journey, I feel very strongly that history is much more than just politics and the military. And we have to learn to see it that way. We have to learn to teach it that way, write it that way, and appreciate it that way. That the someone like Cole Porter is as important as Calvin Coolidge, maybe more so. That someone like Winslow Homer matters immensely in who we are and what we are. Imagine our feelings about the Civil War without, say, the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Take that away. Or take away Mark Twain from American culture. These are very important elements in history, not just literary history or art history or the history of music, they're of history.
I want to have you chat a little bit, Mr. McCullough, about some of those individuals that brought back, even beyond education, just amazing examples, one of which for me was Charles Sumner. And the one observation of black and mulatto medical students led to just a sea change in this country.
Well, Sumner is, I think, one of the more noble figures in the book and in our history. And he was both reviled, despised in the South, when it became a major heroic figure in the North, because he became the most outspoken, powerful voice for abolition in the United States Congress, in the Senate. He had shown no sympathy for slaves in bondage before he went to Paris. He'd shown no interest in it. And while he was there one day, and he wrote about this in his journal, we know exactly when it happened, where it happened, why it happened. He was in a lecture hall at the Sorbonne, and his mind was straying a little bit from the professor's remarks from the platform. And he began studying the other students, and he noticed that the black students, dressed the same as everybody else, were treated exactly the same as everybody else, and they had the same ambitions as everybody had, the same ambitions he did. And he wrote in his journal that night, "I wonder if the way we treat black people in our country has more to do with how we've been and what we've been taught and is not part of the natural order of things." And he came home as if he'd had an epiphany. He came home determined to do something about the abolition of slavery. And he went to work with a fervor, got into politics, got elected to the Senate when he was still in his early 40s. And as a consequence of one particularly powerful speech in which he appeared to be insulting several of his Southern colleagues in the Senate, he was attacked by a congressman from South Carolina, attacked from behind with a heavy walking stick, and nearly beaten to death, a calamity from which he never really recovered, both physically and psychologically. So he paid for his courage, but his courage had a profound effect. And when he died in Boston and was buried the day of his funeral, when the body was taken from Boston's Massachusetts State House on Beacon Hill to the Mount Auburn Cemetery, which is a distance of 5 miles, the whole route, all 5 miles, was jammed with people on both sides of the road the whole way out. Today, there probably isn't one Bostonian in 1,000 who knows who he was, which is a great shame. I've had a wonderful time at work on each of the books that I've undertaken. And I'm very proud of them. But I've never had a better time writing a book than I have with this one. I was 4 years at it, and I would have been happy if it had gone on for another 4 years. But because the material is so interesting, and so much of it had never been looked at. It's a part of the story that's not been told. People know all about the Americans in Paris in the 1920s and the 1930s, which is a whole different subject, but virtually nothing about this period, which is rich beyond imagining in both important people and lives, but also wonderful material to work with.
Well, it seems so relevant today, based on the experiences of these Americans studying abroad. What suggestions do you have for today's educational institutions, their curricula, in America?
Every student ought to have a chance, if possible, if they get the chance or the opportunity awakens or comes to pass, to study abroad. No question about it. And every parent ought to encourage it. I've never known anyone who did it who didn't feel that it was of greatest value, none who regretted it. And I think that we all ought to welcome foreign students as often as best we can to our colleges and universities. And if you're in college with a foreign student, get to know those people, because they know a lot that you don't know, because they come from a different land and a different way of seeing things and different culture. I think it's important that one pursue these dreams when young, because you have many fewer responsibilities or obligations, and you're free to do this in a way that you might never be later on in life. Do it. Go. And you'll never regret it.
Well, Mr. McCullough, thank you very much for taking time out.
This has been a wonderful chance to talk with you, and I appreciate the kinds of questions you ask very, very much.
Part 2 of my conversation with 2-time Pulitzer Prize-winning author David McCullough. He spoke with me by phone from his home in Florida. On Tuesday night, February 28th, Guilford College, with support from Bookmarks, brought the noted historian and author to the Triad. He discussed his new book, The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris, with a packed audience in Reynolds Auditorium in Winston-Salem. After his presentation, McCullough took questions from the audience and signed copies of his new book. You'll find links to The Greater Journey and more on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. You're listening to Triad Arts Weekend on 88.5 WFDD, your NPR News and Triad Arts station from Wake Forest University. I'm David Ford. Seraphic Fire is a remarkable vocal ensemble with several award-winning CDs, including a 2006 Brahms Requiem recording that made the top 10 Billboard classical charts. Their 2010 release of Monteverdi's Vespers of the Blessed Virgin 1610 became the number one best-selling classical album on iTunes. On Saturday night, March 3rd at 7:30, Seraphic Fire comes to St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Winston-Salem, and you'll find links to more information at wfdd.org/triadarts. The twice Grammy-nominated Miami-based choir is one of the four major performing arts organizations in that city, along with the Florida Grand Opera, Miami City Ballet, and the New World Symphony, led by San Francisco Symphony conductor Michael Tilson Thomas. Like Tilson Thomas, Seraphic Fire founding artistic director Patrick Dupre Quigley began conducting early. At the age of 13, he led a small Presbyterian choir in his hometown of New Orleans, and he's never stopped. Patrick spoke with me by cell phone from his home in Miami. I was really impressed with just the presentation of Seraphic Fire online and in the literature. What have you learned marketing-wise along the way? Or do you have lots of mentors around you? Or what's your role in that? Because it's quite a nice presentation.
I made my way through undergrad and graduate school working in a PR firm and in a print shop. So I have a good deal of experience personally. I mean, we sort of operate from the philosophy, which is that the difference between like a working artist and a starving artist is marketing. You know, I mean, it's great if we perform this music and we perform it to the highest level, but if no one knows about it, I mean, it sort of seems a bit narcissistic at that point, you know, that we're basically performing it for ourselves and no one else. Part of our mission, I think, in a lot of ways, is to not only be able to perform the music, but to perform the music for people who perhaps don't have a lot of experience with the music that we're performing. And that takes a bit of packaging on our end in a way that introduces the music, not just you should come because this is Bach, but you should come because Bach is in the context of the greater musical world. Bach is at the peak of the apex. So that's the marketing philosophy behind the whole thing.
You're in good company there in terms of modeling with Michael Tilson Thomas and his ability to contextualize his programs, both for young people and adults. I thought it was really remarkable.
Yeah, no, he's an incredible example of just how you should do it. I mean, one of the things that Michael does, besides being such a genius musician, is that he really is able to distill the essence of the music when he talks to the audience in perhaps two or three sentences that make, you know, the listener say, ah, I have something to hold on to. I get it. I know what I'm listening for, and changes the entire musical experience for the listener just with an economy of words spoken before the piece.
That's a great way of putting it, an economy of words, always important.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm just struck by the quality of what I'm hearing on YouTube. I can only imagine it's a pretty rigorous audition process to get into the group.
Yeah, I mean, the group is composed of sort of an all-star cast of ensemble and solo singers from around the country. We're not really constrained by geography. We're really the American Airlines choir in a lot of ways. You know, our folks fly in, we give them the music 3 or 4 weeks ahead of time. They come, we do 7 rehearsals in 3 days, and then we perform 5 concerts usually. And so it is a reasonably rigorous audition process. You know, we don't necessarily have formal auditions per se. We receive tapes and CDs and emails with MP3s every other day these days. a lot of it is people's backgrounds. So many of the people who sing with us have sung with one of the really fantastic groups in Boston or sung with Conspirare in Austin, Texas. We have a number of former members of Chanticleer and Contus who sing with us. So we're an aggregator of the talent of professional choral singing from around the country. We put 13 people onto the stage, but we work with a roster of singers that's about 45 people at any given time, just because over 50 concerts a year with people who are professors and opera performers and concert performers and teachers themselves, to put 13 people on the stage, need 50 people over the course of the year to do that. So it's an ever-changing cast of musicians that are on the stage with us.
Well, it's a wonderful blending. I was watching the rehearsal, I guess it was, of essentially a run-through of Monteverdi's Vespers from 1610. I was really struck by the variety of textures you're able to get. What are some of your trademarks or what you like to bring to bear in rehearsal?
I see my position as a conductor not as much as sort of a director as I am coach and facilitator. Usually between the 13 people plus myself on the stage, we probably have somewhere between 100 and 150 years worth of musical training on the stage. And so my job with these fantastic, fantastic musicians is to sort of steer us all to the place where we are all sort of acknowledging each other's musicianship to the fullest. I really try to, in a lot of ways, channel our music making in a way that gives up the least from each person. So there are some schools of conducting which would say you go in there and you sort of impose a musical interpretation. And a lot of times what happens then is that you get something that is not nearly as good as what you started with. and, you know, my job as conductor of a group like this is to listen to the first sounds that are made and say, okay, we're 85% of the way there because we already have this incredible sort of core of music making already go on. 15% of it we don't agree on, and I'm going to facilitate agreement.
A look at the concert here in the Triad. Your programs in general have won a lot of recognition. What can we look forward to?
We're sort of performing a wide array of things. The Spanish Renaissance composer Tomás Luis de Vitoria, we're performing music of Maurice Durufle, the French turn-of-the-century composer and organist. On top of that, we're performing a number of pieces which sort of reflect our Miami heritage. A new piece by Alvaro Bermudez, who's a young Colombian-American composer, as well as some arrangements of Rafael Hernandez's rumbas. Some music by Ingram Marshall, which is hymnotic delays, which take their departure point from early American hymnody and the Bay Psalm book. We're performing music by John Tavener and Morten Lordson, which was on one of our Grammy-nominated CDs this year. Perhaps people know the Lordson Omanium Mysterium that will be on the program, sort of a signature work of ours. So, you know, we'll cover about 500 years of musical history over the over the course of the night. So,
is that all? Come on.
Yeah.
I paid top dollar. Yeah,
right.
My thanks to Seraphic Fire founding artistic director Patrick Dupre Quigley. Seraphic Fire was the recipient of the 2006 ASCAP Award for Adventurous Programming, and you can hear the spectacular vocal ensemble live in concert at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Winston-Salem. The performance of music spanning several centuries is Saturday night, March 3rd at 7:30, and you'll find links to more information on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and when we come back from this short little intermission, it's time to dance with Winston-Salem Festival Ballet and their original tribute to the big city. Go hail a cab. Next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Winston-Salem Festival Ballet invites you to come explore the twists and turns of everyday city life through the eyes and movements of founder, artistic director, and choreographer Gary Taylor. Metropolis, a cityscape story screaming to be told, is coming to the Haynes Brands Theater in Winston-Salem with opening night Friday, March 9th at 8 o'clock, followed by shows on Saturday night at 8 and Sunday afternoon at 2. You'll find links to ticket information and more on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. Last week, Gary dropped by WFDD in between rehearsals for a glimpse of his Metropolis. What sorts of things jump out at you when you're thinking of a, you know, big Metropolis?
Those sounds and smells. You know, being a traveler, my mother's British, so I grew up wondering why I love the smell of diesel exhaust, because it reminded me of London. So these sensory things like that are what I sparked upon when I started creating my ideas. Basically a simple list of car horns, diesel smell, trash, noises, you know, ambulances that are so loud that you don't necessarily always hear in a smaller city, but it's prevalent, happening all the time.
And bouncing off the walls of those big buildings.
Ricocheting, echoing. So, you know, all those elements played huge when I started really to lay out the format for it.
Is it a process in which you can conceivably go from, okay, now today is just choreography, tomorrow will be lighting, and the next day will be stage design, or does it have to all interweave every moment?
It interweaves every moment for me. It helps me have a continuity of design element that makes sense for anyone. Mm. And that seems like it clouds the thoughts, but simplifies it for me.
I'm similar in the way I produce the show.
Right.
I've been called an A to Z kind of guy. is that apt for you?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm not a lighting designer, but those elements play a huge part in the way I design how you're going to see something, and not just through a costume or an angle, but through the lights. I mean, I am actually bringing in Craig Stelzenmuller.
That's right. You've collaborated with him for quite a while.
I have, and Craig and I really can just look at each other with a glance and know what needs to be done. You know, we have a basic plot to approach this with, but it will be a work in progress and a design that's very unique. And so it's going to be wonderful to work with Craig. It's going to be a stress reliever for me for the week.
I know another very important aspect of any production you do is the music, and in this case, adding a whole other layer with a variety of perspectives with different composers. This is all original music.
All original music. I mean, some of these works the composers have, but maybe they haven't been presented to the audience and are on CDs and that I've selected. But connecting with these different composers has been very interesting. I mean, one through Monica Wilmont, the violinist with a symphony that's played in my lobby before a show.
That's right, the Winston-Salem Symphony.
Right. Her husband introduced me to one of the composers, Chris Heckman, who's a movie score composer, so his huge symphony kind of quality things, but very intriguing because he does video game composing as well, so it has a different aspect. And after our meeting, when we sat down and initially spoke, I felt like we were twins separated at birth, because every Danny Elfman, Tim Burton concept, or the way he thinks, I love and think like that. That's, I guess, the dark side of me. And then
you're talking about great film score composers. Danny Elfman is a classic example.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So I just knew that, you know, when someone like that, I know that we're going to connect. Eric Schwartz with the School of the Arts has had some brilliant compositions. Pieces that I've selected of Eric's are very groovy, abstract, that sparked me off in another direction. And John Wilson, who has had just an array of different types of music, he throws at me left and right, and it's been wonderful to select his works. And
that's right, and John's a great percussionist as well.
Yeah, so it's not just a straight-up composer working with someone. And then and I've also got Tracy Thornton. He's a pan man. He plays the steel drum. But I've known Tracy for over 20 years. And we've done original work together before, and so I wanted to pull from that, because my first concept was Heartbeat of the City. What is this? You know, the rattling of a car going over a bridge as it makes a rumble, a consistent rhythm, or the, you know, car horns honking and it echoing through the alleyways to actually create a rhythm. You know, simple things like that. And actually, the cool thing about a metropolis or a city like that is you get downtown and you close your eyes and it comes alive in another way. And so those sparks, I knew percussionists would have and understand that concept when I started working on the wanting the music that could relate to that. So it's been exciting.
Neat. I can picture it now. Haynes Brands Theater in Milton Road Center for the Arts. What are you going to do with that space?
I'm going to present the show in a way that if you came to each performance, you could sit in a different part of the theater and get a totally different perspective of what you just saw.
That's unusual.
Very unusual for dance.
Isn't that kind of spinning the ideal on its head? I mean, you're supposed to go and wherever you are, any seat in the house is the perfect seat.
Oh, no. This one is, I'm going to have multiple things going on. I'm going to have multiple angles. There are five different perspectives that you can watch this show at, and only three shows available. So I think you should definitely take advantage of more than one.
But isn't that the way street life is in a big city? I mean, you're on the 50th floor. It's very different than when you're down at street level.
Yeah. What? Why do I keep going back to New York City? I mean, I walk down 49th one way. I walk back the other way. I get a different perspective. So when I wanted to create the work, I wanted them to be able to see the choreography and the way it was presented in a different perspective if they wanted to. I mean, you could come back from intermission and switch a place, and it will be completely different. So that design element for me was really important because I feel like it's very metropolis.
Metropolistic?
Thank you. Very metropolistic, yes.
Everyone has their own concept of what a city is or a metropolis should be. I'm in the audience. I'm sitting there. What am I going to see? What am I going to feel?
Well, the exciting thing is when you show up at the Haynes Brands Theater, you're going to be in a lobby and you'll probably hear live music and it's going to be like you're at a normal theater. But once you step through those doors of the theater, you're not going to feel like you're in a theater anymore. You're going to be in a cityscape. You're going to be on a road. You're going to be down an alleyway. I'm trying to transform the theater into a whole different way of experiencing it, especially for dance. I think for dramas and plays and everything, I think they definitely take you there. For dance, it's usually been historically presented in one type of way. And so I'm actually going to present it in a completely different way. And also, not just that, but the atmosphere when you're there. You could literally close your eyes and feel like you're somewhere else. You could turn a corner and feel like you're someone else. And then all of a sudden a dance production happens there. So it's completely different.
Neat. Call me a cad. My thanks to choreographer Gary Taylor. Metropolis opens Friday night, March 9th at 8 o'clock, followed by shows on Saturday night at 8 and Sunday afternoon at 2. You'll find links to ticket information and more at wfdd.org/triadarts. Well, that's all for today's program. You'll find podcasts and archive programs on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.